lot of contemporary relevance, particularly now, a week before the election. I think it's got huge contemporary relevance. I'm glad we're talking about this a week before the election. Safira and her family sort of sum up several of the dilemmas around identity, around gender, around belonging and emigration, I think, of that we're discussing in contemporary British life. There's the woman's story, the story of suffrage, but also the story of gender inequality in general. Women rising up, which is very much here in fourth wave feminism that we can talk to the panel about. There's also the immigrant story. However royal Safira is, her family story is that of immigrant dispossession and trying to negotiate two cultural identities, which I found a really moving aspect of the book. There's international politics, struggle for Indian independence, the outrage felt against colonial rule, which is traced in the consciousnesses of Safira's family members. The sense that the West is the occupier enrages some of them. It drives them to brave, irrational, sometimes radical acts, extreme acts. On top of all the serious stuff, it's just a really captivating read. And I don't say that because I've been primed to. I sat down one Saturday thinking, right, I'll probably get through a quarter of this morning. And I just carried on reading, and I finished reading that day. And I'm a fairly slow reader. And I cried at the end, and we'll come to that later. But it is surprisingly moving in a way that, you know, historical biographies shouldn't be or aren't. Anita's going to give us a taster from the book, just a couple of paragraphs that captures Safira at the height of her fame and her infamy. So if we can have that read, that'd be brilliant.
Sure. And I have to tell you, this is the first time I'm doing a reading from the book. I mean, I've talked about Safira, and it's a great pleasure to talk about her always. But I haven't actually read from my book, so this is weird. So if you just indulge the weirdness, I hope you don't mind. So this is just a little bit about who she was and why it's significant, the choices that she made. Though she was doing her best to fade into the background, one face stood out among them all. I'll just give you a bit of a background about this. It's Black Friday, a notorious day in politics, and those of you who don't know about it ought to know about it, because it was a turning point in politics here. Emmeline Pankhurst and her suffragettes had been led to believe that the women would be given some kind of vote. A conciliation bill was going through Parliament, and they heard a rumour that Asquith, who had this pathological block when it came to women and the vote, was going to kill it. He was going to kill it in its crib, he was going to cut off the time it had to pass, and they all felt very betrayed. And so they met at a place not very far from Parliament, maybe about 5-6 minutes walk from Parliament. You can still see the building, it's called Caxton House. And they were going to march on Parliament, and they were going to bang down the door until Asquith came out and explained himself. And Emmeline is addressing a group of her suffragettes, in order of 500 in the end. And she surrounded herself with sort of rock star suffragettes on the stage, women who had already or were about to change history. So that is where we are. This is where we are looking at Safira and this stage where Emmeline is speaking and all of these women arrayed behind her. So though she was doing her best to fade into the background, one face stood out among them all. It belonged to a quiet, bird-like woman seated right at the back of the stage. She was dressed in expensive Parisian couture, and her brown face stared back fiercely at those who stared at her. Princess Safira Dileep Singh was as close to an international celebrity as it was possible to be in 1910. Many had been reading about her for years in the popular press. Daughter of a flamboyant Maharaja, goddaughter to Queen Victoria, champion dog breeder, resident of Hampton Court Palace. Fashion pages frequently declared her one of the best-dressed women in the country, and shops would boast about her patronage. There were less desirable facets to Safira's fame, however. She was the daughter of that man, the traitor, the one who lost everything. And whispers followed Safira wherever she went. She was the Dark Princess, granddaughter of the greatest ruler the Punjab had ever known, the descendant of warriors.
There's the fire.
So that's a little bit, like a little thumbnail sketch of her background and how important
she was. So tell me, beguiling introduction, because we want to know more. When did you come across Sophia, and how?
Well, I never intended to write a book. I'm married to an author, so I know how much work it is, and I never intended to do very much work. You know, I'm a journalist, we do considerably less work. But I was on maternity leave in 2010, and it's a strange thing when you work, and I know there are some members of the press here, and they will, you know, attest to this. When you are working in a certain groove, you have blinkers, and so I've always worked in news and politics, and there are only a certain number of things that I would read every day. There's only that much time. But on maternity leave, I suddenly had the time, a little bit of time in between sleeps, burps and vomits, to sort of do things that were quiet, and they had to be quiet things. So I started reading material that I would never normally have read, and there was a local magazine that came through the door, and I was leafing through it in this sort of sleep-deprived haze, and there was a picture. And it was about the article, and of course my eyes couldn't focus on words at that time because I was so tired, but there was an article about a local suffragette exhibition. And they had a picture of a woman, suffragette, selling the militant newspaper outside Hampton Court. And some people are nodding, maybe they've seen it. And it's a great picture, just in of itself. It's a lovely picture. She's standing there, dressed very finely in Edwardian clothes. And it was in black and white, but there was something about it, even though it was in black and white, that just told me that her face, her skin was as brown as mine.
But you knew nothing else?
No, nothing. And, you know, we have, I don't know, Punjabis, you know, I'm ethnically Punjabi, my parents are.
Did you recognise her as a fellow
Punjabi? We have Punjab, you know, you've heard about some Gaydar, we have Punjab. It just suddenly went off the scale. She's not just brown, she looks Punjabi. Yeah. I mean, she does actually look like an aunt of mine.
Fabulous. I mean, I want to ask you, how Indian was she and how British was she? Because this is something that is difficult for her, you know, these identities.
Well, I mean, I sort of touched on it in the little introduction that I did. She was the daughter of the last Maharaja of Punjab, a man who was so famous that he was close to Queen Victoria. He is commemorated. If any of you have been to Osborne House, you'll see a full-length portrait, a rather beautiful portrait by the court artist Winterharter, which Queen Victoria had commissioned, which is painted in Buckingham Palace. And so beautiful was this young boy when he came over. He was only 15 when he came over, his 16th birthday in England. That this portrait was actually reproduced and sold to raise money for the soldiers fighting in the Crimea. So we're talking in that day and age of somebody who was extraordinarily famous. And the thing that set him apart, the thing that made him really very alluring as a celebrity, and I use that word sort of advisedly, was a celebrity turned up to parties that mattered and was seen with people that mattered, was that he was once the custodian of the Kohinoor diamond, which many of you may have seen now in the Tower of London. It didn't look that way when he owned it. You've seen it in all its faceted beauty. That was actually done by Queen Victoria's husband, Albert. But when he owned it, it was like the size and heft of a hen's egg. So, you know, this mythical Maharaja who is known by everybody, the Indian in the court of Queen Victoria. And his what happens is you'd think then his daughter would be automatically granted that status of a celebrity, but something goes catastrophically wrong. He tries to take his throne back. And so everybody then has a second wave of cognizance of this family. The traitor, how dare he? You know, he's trying to raise an army up against the British. He's going to see the Tsar to try and get the Tsar to come and help side the British out of India. And suddenly the family is disgraced, you know, utterly disgraced. Mm. So they hide. I mean, Sophia's mother becomes an alcoholic. She can't stand the way that people hiss at her when she walks past. This woman who was welcomed and fated is suddenly the traitor's wife, the thief's wife. Mm. You know, hiss at her when she goes past. And the family kind of implodes at that time. But then something happens. Queen Victoria is Sophia's godmother. Mm. And she decides to save her, to step in for her goddaughter. And she kind of puts her back together. She gives her tutors, she gives her guardians to look after her, she rebuilds her.
But, you know, Anissa, even though, you know, Queen Victoria comes to their aid and, you know, Sophia and her siblings are protected by the British state, and Victoria herself, they hate Britain. You know, they express their hatred. The children spoke of these horrid English who wouldn't let them all go back and live in India. There's a sense that their protectors are also their enemies, no?
Well, her guardian spied on her, you know, religiously. You know, would send every word that she said would be reported back to the palace.
Yeah.
But Sophia, although those words that you quoted, those horrid English, they were her words at the age of 9.
She was talking this great way. Sense of hate. Yeah.
But she never hated the... What sets her apart from her sister? Her sister hated
Bamba.
The English.
Yeah.
And Bamba in particular was really quite out and out racist. She used to say that you can never trust a white person. You can never have them as friends. And they would argue later in life, Sophia and Bamba, about this. And she would just, I love this, Sophia would refer to Queen Victoria, who had saved them, let's not forget, from penury and disgrace. She would call her Mrs. Fagin, the receiver of stolen goods.
Yeah,
so there was a really uncomfortable situation, but Sophia didn't feel that way. She didn't feel, she wanted to fit in, she wanted to blend in. She's the youngest surviving child of this clan of really quite forceful children. And all she wants to do is disappear and be accepted, a little bit like on the stage.
Yeah. Sorry, you found her diary. I'm utterly fascinated to how you found it and how alive she became for you by reading that diary.
Well, her stuff is so there is a repository of papers at the British Library, which is just called Dilip Singh Papers. And I just decided to read all of them, and suddenly out plopped, and nobody had read it. But, you know, I don't think since it had come, one of the librarians had said, was a diary written by Sophia. And that, you know, you have these slight trembling moments when you're writing something that's supposed to be a religious thing. And it actually, it talks about that moment when she turned from being, I mean, one thing I should say is after she's saved by Queen Victoria, she turns into my worst nightmare. She turns into a very pointless socialite, a little bit like her father. The press called her a thoroughly English gal, notwithstanding her great Oriental name.
But those are her wilderness years, aren't they?
They
before
are.
She, yeah.
But this diary catalogues what turned her into a revolutionary. It's her trip to India and its meeting Indian nationalists, brings her alive.
In 1907, she goes to India, doesn't she?
She does. I mean, she has her first trip to India against all the rules. She's not allowed to go to India. The British absolutely don't want the traitors' children going to India.
Causing trouble.
The Punjab, the north of India, is already bubbling with insurrection. It is the least governable, the most wild part of the empire. And the last thing they want is a Dilip Singh turning up and being this totem for rebellion. Mm. But the girls, the boys don't even try, the girls manage to go. So they go in 1900 and they see the Delhi Darbar, which was a great, huge celebration for Edward VII when he comes to the throne. He doesn't bother to turn up, but everybody else does. And it's a fantastic, huge party. And Sophia and her sisters sneak in. And what happens is she suddenly realises that in London, she is this great lady. She's this kind of Princess Diana character. Yeah. When she goes to India in 1900, she is treated no better than a coolie by the British there. They don't allow her to come to the Darbar. She's not allowed a corner of canvas in the Punjab camp to watch the celebrations. She is shunned. So she suddenly realises that actually, you know, the immigrant, feeling of being the other suddenly hits her in the face. And she goes back to England, and suddenly the parties aren't enough. The high society, she doesn't trust it anymore. And it's the start of her change. And then 1907, when the diary is catalogued, is when she becomes fully politicised. That feeling of not belonging, that sense of I don't know who I am, or this doesn't fit anymore, these clothes don't fit me anymore. She suddenly finds her armour in 1907, things to swap, this uncomfortable clothing that doesn't fit her anymore. And she mixes with nationalists, and she hears their cry. They keep shouting in Punjab. It's a phrase, Awaz do, Awaz do, give us a voice, give us a voice, give us a voice. They're shouting, give us some sense that we control our own destiny. And she comes back to England, and she hears the same cry, give us a voice, coming from the suffragettes. And suddenly she's found her reason. She's found where she fits, and that's where she fits.
And I wonder, I mean, you've got so many interesting women in the book. There's so many sort of books you could have written. For example, you know, you've got Sophia's mother, grandmother, Jindan, who tried her utmost to retain power from the Raj. So she's imprisoned, she escapes prison dressed as a beggar. You have Bamba, who goes back to India, and I know, you know, she's as racist, but actually she's a revolutionary in her own right. You know, she's fighting, it's implied,
yeah,
for the struggle for Indian independence.
She's angry.
She's angry.
Less channeled anger, a more destructive anger, I would argue,
right,
from her. But
She is angry. Yeah. But there's so many. Sort of, I wondered why you wrote, why Sophia was the woman you decided to write about. Was it that original picture that you saw, rather than Bamba, all these other extraordinary... The grandmother's story sounds fabulous.
Oh, gosh, I mean, Rani Jindal, and I really hope someone does write a book about her, because to me, she was the original suffragette. So she was... You have to imagine, Ranjit Singh, the Lion of Punjab, Sophia's grandfather, was the greatest... one of the greatest kings India has ever known. He united the North in a way nobody had ever done before. He was the one who amassed this extraordinary wealth and took the Kohinoor diamond as his own. But his wife, so he had many wives, but his youngest wife was the kennel keeper's daughter. So when he was 54 and Jindan was just about 16, this wily kennel keeper used to just keep flinging his daughter up into this larger space, this white bearded, white haired, and say, take her as your wife, she'll rejuvenate you. She'll rejuvenate her. You know, I mean, the Rolling Stones have a similar philosophy, but you know, he kept saying it. And then finally, you know, he sort of gives it. He marries her at the age of 17, and nobody thinks she'll amount to much. She has this boy, Dilip Singh, Sophia's father. No one thinks he's going to amount to much. He's not next in line. But what happens when Ranjit Singh dies is that all of the other people, all of the other claimants, very happily murder each other. They stab, bludgeon and poison each other to death.
It's like a Tudor court.
It is. I mean, there are wonderful assassinations. There's one where one of the... I'm not really this awful, but I do find this hilarious. So it's a very noble prince is returning back to Lahore, and there's an archway and a huge block of stone falls on him, and it just misses him. It knocks him off his feet, but it misses him. And he walks away, and he's found 2 days later with his skull caged in, and the court doctor says it was a side effect from the accident 2 days ago. So, you know, those kind of really extraordinary... But then when Jindan is the last one standing, when Dilip is the only one left, the kennel keeper's daughter, and there are all of these great... The Punjabis are a great martial race, so there was a fantastic standing army there, really very fierce and very noble generals, and some of the big noble families were represented in the Sikh court. Suddenly, the kennel keeper's daughter says, I'm coming out of Paradise, and I'll go home. I will be the regent. He is my son. He's not your puppet. He is my son. And she sits next to the throne, and she makes the decisions. So, yes, I mean, I think she's extraordinary.
She's extraordinary.
And her story is so sad.
Yeah.
So sad.
So Bamba's story is interesting, but I wondered why Sophia didn't become embroiled with the fight for Indian independence in India, and why she came back and Bamba didn't. And I wondered why she didn't channel her sort of spirit into that cause.
India wasn't her country.
Country.
It really wasn't. Mm. It is kind of that immigrant feeling that we still have today. If you're born somewhere, she was born, let's not forget, she was born in Belgravia and she lived in Suffolk. Mm. and then via Brighton back to central London and this sort of celebrity lifestyle where she is fated by everybody who matters in London. She does not feel Indian. Mm. But then after going to India and seeing the way the British treat the Indians, she no longer can feel in all conscience British. Mm. So she is so alone and lonely and outside.
Such a sense of sadness.
Yeah.
That's an undercurrent in this really vibrant, adventurous life story. There's a real sadness lurking beneath
And no more so than in, you know, her love life. I know probably someone always asks.
Yes, okay, so I was going to ask.
Yes, okay. Well, there you go. I mean, you know, this sort of, I think the whole problem of her existence sort of coalesces on what happened to her. She did not marry. Now, why didn't she marry? She didn't marry because when she was this great debutante, she was a very good dancer, she was a very good musician. She used to play Rachmaninoff, apparently, better than anybody. You know, somebody said how romantic her sensibility. They would dance with her. These dashing men would dance with her, but they would never marry her. Because nobody wanted, in the words of the day, mongrel children. In fact, I mean, there's something I quote in the book that talks about Dilip Singh's children as being the dusky tadpoles that roam the streets of Brighton. So nobody will marry her. Now, when she goes to India and she meets Indians, they're nothing like the men she has grown up with, who she has known, that she has danced with. They have a different sensibility. And her sister, Bamba, really wants her to get married to. She keeps flinging sort of men in her direction. And when Sophia is in London and Bamber is in Lahore, she keeps sending sketches of gorgeous young Sikh men. But this is not her world. And she writes. She writes in her diary. I don't understand these people.
You know, could be describing the British Asian
diary. Arranged marriage. Today. Well, I know. People who suddenly are told to marry someone back home from your home village. And you know, your hair suddenly starts falling out because you don't know.
And also the sort of unbelonging in either place. Hers is a contemporary story, as I said in the beginning. But she is this eternal immigrant. There's homelessness, there's a lack of rootedness. It struck me as quite tragic. But at the end, and I was moved by this, she asked for her ashes to be scattered in India. And I wonder, this is such a moving detail that you put in, and do you think she ever felt British by the end? Do you think she ever felt that Britain was her home by the end?
I think she had a really complicated relationship
to home.
But also to India, the notion of home.
Mm.
I think by the end, she had lived to see Britain torture her, throw her away, and then sort of slightly... Because, you know, there are these years when she completely falls from grace, where King George V and Winston Churchill are both on her case. I mean, they are on her case because of her suffragette activity. And I hopefully we'll talk a bit about the kind of stuff that she did. And for those who haven't read it, the bravery of the suffragettes is something I think really, particularly 7 days before an election, we ought to be thinking about. But she falls down again. Then she's sort of like dispossessed by Britain. But what about India? She lives to see partition. She lives to see Punjab in particular ripped apart. Rivers of blood, the biggest exodus of humanity, I think even to this day, the crossing over the lines of partition to Punjab. So what does she feel at the end? Well, you can look at her funeral. I think that tells you quite a lot, actually, because she was left really detailed instructions about her funeral. She wanted Gotterdammerung to be played, which is in itself actually really interesting because it was German. And it was just after World War II, and you're not meant to like German things. But her sister loved, one of her sisters, Catherine, who we haven't even spoken about, got her story. Lesbian, moved to Germany through the First World War, you know, and so only had to move because of Hitler. No, not at all. No, but she had to leave because the Nazis were closing in, and they were saying, you know, you cannot be here anymore. So she asked for Gotterdammerung to be played. She is surrounded by her English adopted family, who we maybe will talk about. But she asked, I think most significantly, she asked for money to be left to girls' schools. And bear in mind that partition brought out the worst in Punjabis. It began with reason. You know, people saw their families and loved ones murdered on these death trains and all of the appallingness that went on. But she left a son to a Hindu girls' school, a Muslim girls' school, and a Sikh girls' school. And she asked for her ashes to be taken back. But the only family that she really knew and really loved, and I think her real family towards the end, were her housekeeper, her housekeeper's daughter, and these three evacuees from London who she took in during World War II, who she loved like a lioness, in their words.
Which is really rather lovely, you know, sort of conception of this other family, this family she created around her. It was nothing like the nuclear family.
It's so weirdly contemporary. It's a family that suddenly, you know, a family
made up of mainly women.
Right.
So do you think that she died in 1948, partition and independence happened in 1947. Did she regard it as a tragedy rather than a triumph then, do you think?
Well, the great sadness of writing Sophia's story is that she was an extraordinary archivist. I mean, really extraordinary in so many ways, but she treasured letters that were written to her. And so you find sort of great clumps of letters. And it's taken me all over the world and to many different sources to find those letters. But the letters she wrote to people haven't been conserved. Mm. And they are scattered. I mean, I found some. But I didn't find her actually talking about the partition.
Right.
But you sort of get to know a person after spending 4 years with that person, which is, you know, in effect what they did with Sophia. You sort of feel like you get to know that person. And everything about her life and about her journey has taught me that that would have been one of the saddest days of her life.
Yes.
That India is free, but at what cost? Because these were people she loved. Lahore, which went to Pakistan, was the seat of her grandfather's and her father's kingdom.
And it was a Sikh stronghold, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. I mean, but it was a place where, you know, Ranjit Singh is famous in Indian history for uniting Hindus, Muslims, and Sikhs. You know, he was the one who didn't knock down the mosques. He took Muslim wives. Mm. You know, he was a great uniter. Mm. And suddenly, you know, her country that she really wanted to be free and really, you know, was under the spell of the nationalists who gave their lives for freedom, suddenly it's ripped apart. So I think, like every other thing in her life, it was so bittersweet.
So bittersweet, and yeah. Such a grand irony there. But, you know, you mentioned this earlier, and you capture very vividly in this book the horrors that were inflicted on protesting suffragettes. I mean, we just, perhaps some people sort of now dismiss them as these sweet women in bonnets and holding up banners. But, you know, on the streets of London, Manchester, wherever elsewhere, they were being beaten up, as you say in this book, you know, sexually molested.
It was almost state-sanctioned sexual assault.
Yes.
Because Winston Churchill, particularly during Black Friday, which is where the book starts, where she's about to go on this march, side by side with Emily in Pankhurst, the police had been told, don't make arrests, because we are sick of these women clogging up our prison systems with their damned hunger strikes. And women were starving themselves to the point of death.
Mm.
You know, the suffragettes, and the greatest sadness for me, and maybe the young panel will talk about this, is how disconnected young women in particular are with that story that is not so far away from us now. It wasn't so long ago that I think 3/4 of this audience would not have been deemed fit to vote because of your ovaries. Because it made you stupid and hysterical, and so you weren't fit to vote. And these women went out, they were, boxes and boxes of stuff in the Kew archives of sexual assault. The policemen were grabbing them around the breasts, putting their knees up between their legs, throwing them into crowds of men saying, do what you want with these bitches, and using that kind of language. And women at the time believed that bruising to the breast caused cancer. Mm. So, you know, for months after they'd been hurt, they were worried that they might develop cancer.
And this is a side of the suffragette sort of struggle that we haven't really read about very much, you know.
No.
I don't think so.
No.
I don't know where, you know, did you research that particular
I knew a bit because being a political journalist and having called myself a feminist for as long as I have, and I am, I'm a very proud feminist, I knew that it was hard. But actually going to the testimony of women who described what was done to them, and then the recourse. And also Sophia was there. So on Black Friday, that episode that I keep alluding to, I almost brought a club with me, but then I thought I'd actually get into trouble on the train. But I'll tell you about the club story in a minute. But on Black Friday, she's penned up against St. Stephen's Gate. If you know Westminster, it used to be sort of the main entrance. And there's a police line in front of them. And they see these contingents of women arriving at 5-minute intervals, because they can't all come together because they're breaking public order legislative laws at that time. So they had to come in small groups. And after Emmeline and her rock stars have arrived and they're penned up against the gate, they have to stand there and watch hour after hour as their friends, their comrades, are having their hair pulled, being slapped, being thrown on the ground, and they won't give up. They won't stay down. And there's one particular woman who Sophia sees who is being picked up by a policeman and thrown down against the pavement really hard. She gets up. She's picked up. She's thrown down against the pavement really hard. She picks up, thrown down again. And Sophia thinks she's going to black out. And if she blacks out, then God knows what's going to happen to her. So she does this extraordinary thing of diving through the police line straight into this riot that is going on. Please go to Parliament Square and imagine this going on in front of the mother, and it is called the mother of all parliaments. The mother looked on as her daughters were being treated this way by the country. And she dives in, between the police officer, who's again got hold of this woman, there's a lot of throw on the floor, and she jumps up in between. Now, you've got to imagine, this woman was you know, Ladies Realm and all these women's magazines were coming out around the same time. She was a paparazzi princess. She was known. It would be like having Kate Middleton jump up in the middle of your riot. The police officer, quite understandably, drops the woman and starts walking away. This brown, famous, screaming figure is shouting at this man. But instead of just letting it go and thinking, yeah, that's the result, you know, the woman say, she follows him, saying, tell me your number, tell me your number. Because at that time, you know, they had their identifying marks, which police station they were. And she keeps shouting, he keeps trying to lose her, he keeps going into, she keeps following him, she's buffeted and bashed, but she remembers the number, V700, she sees it, she just keeps chanting, V700, V700. That riot outside the House of Commons lasted for 5 hours. And she was arrested, like everybody else, and she was taken to, she was told to turn up at Bow Street magistrates because they would all be sent to prison, but in the end, Winston Churchill was all so embarrassing, Churchill said, just let them all go, we cannot take this testimony in court, just get rid of them. But she doesn't, again, let it drop. So she writes, first of all, to the commissioner of the Metropolitan Police, saying, I'd like to talk about Constable V700, and then he says, shit. So he sends it around. It gets buffeted between, you know, the station and him, and it gets escalated because she won't let it go. And suddenly, again, one of those trembling moments I came across in Kew archives, in boxes that are so mystically labelled, they could be in a pyramid somewhere in Giza. I came across this piece of paper, and it just said, in her file, send no more response to her, signed WSC, Winston Spencer Churchill. God. So, you know, she escalated, she wouldn't let things go, and I love that about this woman. I think that's just great. She could have just, you know, done something very brave and heroic that day, but it wouldn't have lasted. Mm. And what she wanted to do was do something that lasted.
But she had a special place in all of this because she was basically immune. The government seems too scared to arrest her, to imprison her. So that put her in an odd place, it didn't
really,
it?
Because she really, more than anything, she wanted to go on hunger strike. Mm. You know, she was a real publicity grenade, and Emmeline and the suffragettes knew it. Mm. So they employed her in really obvious ways. There were these fantastic things called press carts, which used to drive through London, and the suffragettes would drive them to the most aggro places they could find. So Drury Lane, for example, they'd park up this press cart, and they would be harangued by the men coming out of the theatres in Drury Lane, and they would argue and heckle. Now, not only did Sophia go and sell the newspapers, she drove the carts. So you have these wonderful pictures, which are in the book, of her driving these carts, dressed in the finest high fashion, you know, driving these carts. And she wanted, she knew, and they knew, the value of having her sent to prison. But every time she was arrested, they let her go. Because can you imagine, Queen Victoria's goddaughter is starving herself to death. They just couldn't. But more than that, that's embarrassing and awful enough, prompting King George V, when he came to the throne, saying, can we not get her out of Hampton Court? But that was bad enough. But what they really didn't want, again, the Raj, they did not want the North to have their warrior princess. Yes. And the British tried and actually were very successful in erasing and excising this woman from history. So she was punished, not in the way that her sister suffragettes were necessarily, but she was punished by being deleted.
And we might know about, we might have known about her sooner than now had she not been so aristocratic. And
I mean, I just the deletion was just so callous and comprehensive. Mm. I didn't want to write a book. I never felt I was going to write a book, but it was just because when I saw that picture, the first thing I did was I reached for a book. I said, there must be some book. I mean, this is extraordinary. And there wasn't one. Mm. And so then I had to sort of start looking, and every time I looked, there was like 10 more questions that came up, and then 10 more. I'm delighted that my editor and the managing editor of Bloomsbury is here, Alexandra Pringle, who has been an absolute delight to work with. But I remember having a conversation with Alexandra when she took on the book. She said, how long do you think this is going to take you? I said, year and a half, and it didn't. It took. She knew it. I didn't know. Well, I mean, all in all, from beginning, from that moment, my son is 5, and the book came out in January. So you know, you look at my son, and you can see how old and how long this obsession has been going on. He's grown up with the fight. He calls her the fighting princess. you're fighting Princess Mummy.
Hey, but they talk of the pram in the hallway, but you know, and how it's impossible for women to sort of have children and work. But this it sounds like the pram in the hallway was really good for you.
It wouldn't have happened. I mean, none of this would have happened. It wouldn't have happened if I weren't. If I wasn't there, if I wasn't that tired, if I hadn't seen that picture, yes. it is as fateful as that. It's like people say to me, you know, how did you come across Sophia? It's like, I didn't. She barged her way to my house. She really did.
Via motherhood.
Yeah, I mean, she literally landed on my doorstep, yeah. And it was just screaming.
How
it
lovely.
Was so screaming,
how lovely.
Write me. And so that's why it got ripped.
Yeah. Now, at the end, this is one of the bits that I felt really moved by. She's sort of living this unconventional, rather marvellous sort of women's, you know...
Women's collective.
Yeah.
It's a sort of... Buckinghamshire. Yes, that's right.
And she's talking to the daughter, the very young daughter, of her sort of housemaid, is that right?
Her housekeeper.
Her housekeeper.
Yes, her housekeeper, yeah.
And she's talking to this woman, this little girl, Anita tracked down this girl now, you know, elderly.
Living, she's in
living.
Her 80s. And again, that's how close we are to the suffragettes. I interviewed three people. I was lucky enough, three people who were alive who knew Princess Sophia.
Which is extraordinary,
that's
and you're
how
right.
Close
we
are.
We can
to
touch.
That
yes,
you can touch.
Almost
you can touch
her.
Them.
Yeah.
You know, they told me how she smelt, how she walked, what her voice sounded like, how she laughed. You know, that's how close we are. Not just how close I felt then to the protagonist. I'm blessed, but every time I do anything to do with politics, I just think that's how close we are to a time when you lot wouldn't have voted.
Mm. And just on that note, and I hate to interrupt you,
no.
I hate to interrupt our conversation, but I really think this tiny little passage is worth reading if you do.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Yeah, just a sort of couple of paragraphs where she asks this Sophia, makes this little girl promise something to her.
So this little girl who's the housekeeper's daughter, and the housekeeper's an impossible woman. I mean, nobody likes her apart from Sophia because she is just... rude.
There's quite a lot of comedy between them.
Yeah, they are. I mean, they are the quintessential odd couple.
But they're this George and Mildred sort of
thing. They are. I mean, they are. They're just ludicrous together. I mean, Sophia is drawn to her because she is a housekeeper who clearly doesn't know her place and throws rages. I mean, the first time Sophia says she's going to India,
she says, I want to go.
I want to see an elephant. And then throws herself on the floor and has a screaming fit. And so Sophia finds this so hilarious. She takes her to India. You know, so, but it's her daughter who is a tiny baby, and the housekeeper says, will you be her godmother? And again, this is, you know, completely smashing the social stratification of the day. Mm. She not only accepts, she says, I would like to give her my name. So the lady in question is called Drobna, and it's a diminutive of Sophia's middle name. Her name was Sophia Alexandrovna Dilip Singh. So she calls her Drobna, because it means daughter. So that's how that relationship, finally she has a daughter, if you think about it that way. And so this is a little bit about Drobna. The princess was...
I'm so sorry.
It's all right. Okay, but it's a really funky retake, Alexandra.
Not
wow.
It's
do you know, it's not... You're fine, you're forgiven, it's fine. So this is... This is Sophia and her goddaughter.
And this is the promise that she's asking.
That's right. So she would regularly take Drobna round Hampton Court, and she would torture the poor girl. She would make her memorise all of the flowers and recite them by name. She would teach her how to eat like a lady, so she had to eat a peach with a knife and fork. I mean, she just generally was a bit of a nightmare godmother. But the princess was delighted by everything her little protégé did and said. And apart from the regular gifts, Drobna would be the only child she would attempt to leave her most precious legacy to. We'd be walking, said Drobna, and she'd be telling me about the world and elections and how important they were, and then she would just kneel down in front of me, looking me right in the eye, and she would say, I want a solemn promise from you, even though I don't think I knew what a solemn promise was at that stage. And she would say, you are never, ever not to vote. You must promise me. When you are allowed to vote, you are never, ever ever to fail to do so. You do not realise how far we have come. You must promise me.
It's really powerful stuff, isn't it?
And she did.
Yeah.
She has always
now,
voted.
The duty to vote. So this is what everybody's thinking about a week before a general election. And what do you think in the light of, you know, Russell Brand's well-publicised apathy, the whole Newsnight, you know, Ed Miliband, you know, who needs to vote? Do you really think that every woman has a duty to vote because of the struggle of the suffragettes? Or did they afford us the luxury to choose to vote? That's what they were doing.
I really honestly don't. I think that we are so lucky that we live in a democracy. I mean, before I was sort of a Westminster-bound kind of a journalist, and now I do a program called Any Answers, which is all based on what politicians are saying and doing here now. But I used to cover a lot of foreign affairs stuff. And believe me, I've covered elections in countries where they have had ballot boxes blown up and they're still queuing to vote, where people in their family have been murdered for the temerity of voting for not the local crime lord stroke candidate. We don't have any of that. But we do have a chance. One chance to really flex our muscles. It's not the only chance. It's not all that we should do. But if you believe that you have a part in society, then you have a part to play. I do think it's a moral duty. I really do. So it tires me. It exhausts me. And it depresses me when beardy weirdies, or whatever you want to call them, will stand up and say, don't bother. Because why would you say that? If you don't believe in anyone on the ballot sheet, then turn out and spoil your ballot. Do it, because you at least will be visible. Why do you want to remove yourself?
Mm. So come in, youth panel. I think this is very, very important that you come in. Katrina or Tamsin, I think you had a question related to the election, to women, to representation, so go for it.
That's right. It was great to hear about your book, by the way. Thank you.
Oh, no, thank you very much for coming.
I have a question about your book, and I wanted to know...
Sorry, can we just wait for the microphone?
Oh,
because it's
yes,
important.
Sorry, I thought my voice was loud. Yeah. The question is related to your book, and what I wanted to know is, did writing the book change your perception about the right or the importance of women to vote? Did you have a different opinion before you wrote the book?
I always thought it was important. I've been raised to understand, I mean, you know, my forebears came from that same India where people were struggling to get the vote, I would say. And so I've always been brought up with the knowledge that it is such an important duty. It's a duty, that's what I was brought up to believe. But I have now, because of this book and because of talking about it a lot and discussing it, debating it, particularly with women journalists, I've come across this kind of sneering attitude of, well, of course it's not enough to just say, you know, the suffragettes did this to us and we have to vote. Right? That's the thing, because... And people do have gripes and they have justifiable complaints about the system that we have, or, you know, the way in which their voices are heard, or the way in which politicians might interpret their needs. But I immediately take umbrage at that sneering, because you damn well do owe them. You really do. They put their lives, their families' lives and everything on the line so that you could have that right. And it is a right. So that changed my mind. It also started me looking at, you know, where are we in politics? Because I get to interview, and I have done, I used to present a programme called The Daily Politics, where I used to interview front bench characters, and we'd have women. Not that many. I started looking at the numbers. Now, do you know, since 1918, which is when women were given a qualified vote, not even every woman, not equal votes, not equal rights, but women over 30 or property-owning women were given the right to vote, I think there have been some 364 women in total in the House. In total. Now, I don't know about you, but that seems ridiculous to me. Doesn't it? Doesn't that sound ridiculous to you?
You know, in the context of Blair's Babes, do you think it's getting what... You know, do you actually think we're slowly inching towards something more equal? Or do you think it's not inching, it's sort of regressing.
I mean, I don't think it's just about that. I think it's about groups suddenly removing themselves from the landscape. So whether you refer to the young or women, I mean, last election, I think, was the first time women have normally kept parity with men when it comes to the vote, and they dipped last time round. Why would that happen? And I'm really worried about this election. I'm really worried that, you know, that disconnect, because that's the story, isn't it? The disconnect is the story. Mm. That will it continue? I really hope not. I really, really hope not. And look at the makeup of the house. What is it? 78% of the people who represent you are men. Mm. 78%. Does that sound right to you? Mm. Does it? And it's all about participating in ownership. You know, you're not. It's not. I'm not just saying that you know you have to turn out and participate. You have to feel your sense of ownership of the country that you live in. The sense that, you know, it's not just about you and your nuclear family, but it's about you and your street and your town and your society and all of those things. It's that cohesive thing which I really fear is kind of being pulled apart a little bit by this malaise that is so much the story at the moment.
Yeah.
So I worry. I mean, I really hope it doesn't happen at this election. I worry. Mm.
Yeah. And you talked just earlier, you said, you know, I'm a feminist, and people were allowed to say that again. It's not a dirty
word.
It's
weird, isn't it?
But because for about a decade, it just became an embarrassment. It's an embarrassing word. Nobody is feminist.
You can say it here, but you still can't say it. I found one really interesting thing in India. It's a little bit of an edgy word.
I really?
You were sort of chatting to me about that. Is that something you wanted to talk about?
So my question about feminism and sort of cultural identity. And, you know, there's so many sort of different ideas and conceptions of what feminism is, and how do you think the struggle for gender equality changes in different cultural contexts?
Well, it's interesting. We were chatting before, so I know that was on your mind, and it's been on my mind a lot, and particularly because I've had the very great privilege, and it's felt like sort of taking Sophia home in a way, sort of talking to her. I took the book to the Jericho Literary Festival, and it was wonderful to take back this icon to India that had no idea about her at all, none. I mean, we didn't have any idea about her here, and we had no idea about her there. And I did a few interviews there, and it was really funny, particularly with women journalists, where they would suddenly say, lovely interview, lovely, 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 and then they'd go, and it says here that you're a feminist.
Am I reading that right?
Feminist. And I would say, well, yeah, I am. And I would be really hurt because it was the women who were asking me in interviews, like, you're a feminist. What's a feminist? And I find that still, you know, because there is something really interesting happening in India, really interesting. That's not the, that is not the sweeping experience of India. You know, those women who came out after the Delhi rape and said, this is not happening anymore, you do something about it. Right now there's some legislation being discussed about marital rape, where a lot of people are coming up and saying, you know, what's the argument? Women are just going to use this against spouses, you know, as if it's like, you know, the loading the dishwasher argument and getting out of a marriage. But there are women, particularly, it's not just in the cities, you know, Delhi is a hotbed of this kind of feminism that is suddenly springing up, but also in the villages and the panchayats, where women are just suddenly, the panchayats are the little sort of community groups that govern a village and a town, and suddenly there are little pockets, and they may not want to call it feminism, but that is what it is. I'm sorry to say that is, you know, if they don't like the word, that is what they are and that is what it is. And, you know, I don't mind what you call it, but I would call it a feminist. Mm. Yes, I am a feminist.
Brilliant. But before, I want to slide in my own last question, and then I think it's time to sort of put, you know, to invite questions to Anita. But I've got tons, but I feel that I can't hog our time and I need to be a bit more collegiate. I do want to ask you this before we open up. It's the fact that, you know, this year we've been told something, and Meryl Streep's going to be, you know, the suffragettes are back in, Emmeline Pankhurst's life story is going to be, you know, done Hollywood style, Meryl Streep's going to star in it. We also have fourth wave feminism, very clever young women writing books, campaigning for change. Where do you think, you know, a suffragette like Sophia and the suffragette story fits into all of this? Are they coming back into a fashion? You know, is Meryl Streep single-handedly allowing them back into fashion?
No.
Have we forgotten? Because earlier on you said we remember the second waivers and all the rest of it, but there's a disconnect. What
Well, I think there's something really good happening at the moment where, you know, you can sort of stand up and say that you're a feminist these days, and it's not like standing up and admitting that you have some kind of, you know, a substance abuse problem. You know, you can say it and be proud of it, and I'm really glad that's happened. I mean, Emma Barnett is here, who's doing a great deal of work in that field for the women's section of the Telegraph. You know, it's really good, and there is a section by the Telegraph.
Mm.
The Telegraph to women. That's a huge achievement. You've got Laura Bates, Everyday Sexism, yeah. Which you know, is doing a huge amount of work. Not just the stuff that Laura does on Twitter or online, getting people to talk about what is unacceptable and acceptable behaviour, but going into schools and talking to young people about what young women should expect, how they should expect to be treated. Mm. I mean, these things are really very good. Have the feminists come back? The suffragettes come back. How did we ever let them go? How is it that I wasn't taught this subject at school properly? How is it that I bet even those of you who call yourself feminists can name maybe 3 or 4 suffragettes? Mm. My great privilege in writing this book is coming across woman after woman who. These women took my breath away.
Mm.
Yeah, I can name that Emma Sprossen, who had nothing, went to prison for not paying her taxes. Absolutely refused to pay. You know, stood up against some of the most powerful men in the realm. You had another suffragette who went and exposed the death camps in South Africa. It was a woman who went and did that. Took on Kitchener, no less.
Mm.
It has been an honour to find these women, and it has been upsetting that I haven't had them in my life for longer.
Mm. And you know, why isn't this piece of history on the GCSE social history syllabus? You know,
I don't, God knows, I don't. I did the Tudors till I wanted to throw up. So yeah. Why I can't tell you about timbered buildings, but you know, I don't know.
On that note, hands up, who's got a question about the suffragettes and or current day feminism or anything else? There's a gentleman. No, there's a woman there with glasses.
Yeah.
Thanks very much. Just the classic, equal but different. How do you stand on that?
I was trying to understand that question. So can I ask you what you mean by that? Because I don't like slogan questions. Because I think we sort of understand them a different way. So when you say equal but different, what is it that's in your mind?
I'm not committed to that slogan, I just want to see what kind of feminist you
need. I'm a feminist who believes that no matter what.
Women are fundamentally the same.
I think women should be treated with. I'll tell you what I think. I think women
not
should
being
be.
Slow-nish
or no. No, I'm not. I honestly, because it's really interesting when people ask that kind of question where they're coming from. And my belief is that it does not matter what your whether you've got ovaries or testes, you deserve a certain amount of respect from the society that you live in, and you should not be precluded from opportunities because of what you're born in.
Mm.
So equal but different, I need to know more of what you mean.
Okay, so
by that.
Sorry, can we wait for the microphone? Because we can't hear it this side, sorry.
I don't know, I was just thinking, it's really interesting to talk about it. So.
If you were playing table football and they said, oh, I bet you went gentle on her because she was a girl, I know that's a highly trivial example, but are you being, your sex is so much part of the way you're being treated, and it's like you're being special measures because of who you are, you're being considered, but not in a way that you would
actually. I think it's more about opening doors than creating boxes that fit. I think that's what I mean. So, you know.
But saying women should be in Parliament because representation is in itself good enough.
Representation is really important.
Mm. I'm not saying it's not.
Yeah, no, I think
but
it's.
Just because they're there doesn't mean they're really being heard.
Well, I think it's better to have a more obvious equality of representation than to have what we have at the moment.
Mm.
I agree.
Honest.
I don't think they necessarily have to be exclusive.
Yeah. Well, I mean that's sort of. I think that if you have a governing structure that reflects the people that it governs, then you have less of a disconnect and less of this sort of kind of this profoundly depressing removal of great swathes of our society from our democracy.
There was a question here from the youth panel again. So
it's not really related to youth, but thank you. So I was thinking when I was listening to you speaking, I'm an immigrant. Sophia was an immigrant as well, and she saw all the Brits treated immigrants. And I was imagining in my head, what would she think now if she was here now, living in England today? What would Sophia think about the way England is treating asylum seekers, refugees, immigrants? What would she think?
Well, I'll tell you one of the first causes. So I said she went to India in 1900, and that's when she suddenly was uncomfortable with the clothes that she wore. And maybe this will answer your question, but she came back looking for something. She hadn't yet found the suffragettes. This is 1900. They hadn't yet registered on her radar. But she did find a group called the Lashkars, and I don't know how many of you have heard of the Lashkars. The seamen, yes, that's right. They used to transport goods for the Raj. So they did that kind of grimy, invisible labour. So they were largely unseen, but when they were seen, people like Arthur Conan Doyle wrote about them. And they used to talk, he used to write about, you know, many of the vilest antecedents. You know, they were seedy, they were other, they were somehow, wicked, you know, wicked. But in reality, they were people who were grafting in the worst places and worst conditions, often with no shoes to wear, coats to wear. This is how extreme their situation was. But they were those who'd heard of them. Most people hadn't heard of them, couldn't see them, but those who had heard of them demonised them. And that was something, that was Sophia's first cause. So what she did was she started raising money for a home, a haven for the Lashkars, where they could go and they could get at least something warm to eat and some clothes on their back and maybe some money to get home if that's what they wanted, that's where they wanted to go. So what would she think about people being demonised or treated badly or invisible? I think, you know, the deeds, not words, speak volumes, I think. Yeah.
Yes.
I just wondered what you think the reason is that, given this lack of representation, beyond the obvious, why are we still distrusted to have power in government or to be represented? What do you think that's about?
It's a good, very, very good question. So I have been thinking about it, and I don't think I've got the answer yet. And they're also, it's a car crash of eventualities that led us here. First of all, what serving in Parliament used to mean is changing. It is changing. If anyone's seen the fantastic Michael Cockrell documentary about what goes on behind the walls of Westminster, it used to be punishing hours, late night drinking, boys' clubs, and that has led to a backlog of blockade, if you like. That is changing now, but the perception of being in this system is just catching up, I think. To answer your question, does seeing more women make a difference? I think it does, because I think women, I've met doing these sort of book talks, lots of very idealistic women who are political, who seek to serve, they want to serve, and all too often they come up and they say, but I just don't want to be in that pit of shouting and screaming and that boys, you know, sort of terrace, football terrace, as, you know, that's what the description one woman used to me. Now, it's that's chicken and egg, because unless you get more women there, that perception doesn't change. But I'm saying to anyone who does come up to me that it is changing. It is still worth, it's worth pushing your, you can't leave the brave ones who do put themselves forward, like the suffragettes. It's the same feeling I have towards the suffragettes and sort of leaving them out in the cold of history or anything else. You can't leave them to do it on their own. So I really, every time I meet an idealistic woman, I say, stand, do it, try it. It will change. It's not as bad as you think, but it will be better than you could possibly imagine if you're there.
So do you think that it's not a deliberate exclusion of women in Parliament? You know?
I think it's cultural. It's over time it's become that way. Yeah. I mean, I've gone to party conferences where, you know, sort of the when the Blair Babe stuff was happening, that was all terribly nuts, wasn't it? But, but you know, I mean, whatever, the, those are the sillinesses of it, but the fact was a lot more women became visible in politics. No. And, you know, what, I get very irritated when somebody is talking about the footwear someone is wearing when they're actually making a really serious point about extradition law. I'd really like to hear a bit more about what that means, you know. So I think it's just an unholy cataclysm of events that has led us to this, but I think that it will be sort of very brave, idealistic women again who do it and change it, and they will. They're there. I'm meeting them all over the country. Mm. They're there.
I really want to ask a final question, but I know that's greedy. So if someone... This is the final question, so... Oh, God. well, I'm being guided to this hand over here.
Hello. What do you make, and if people haven't heard of it, that there is a growing number of women interested in joining the Women's Equality Party, which some people have said Sandy Toksvig could be the leader of?
Yes, I saw that today. I'm it's a bit late to that particular story. How was it, Emma?
It was a bit ramshackle, right. But it was all well-intentioned, and there's some really clever, brilliant women there, and they are frustrated with it still taking the amount of time, like the statistics you just said. So they see themselves as a very short-lived party.
Yeah, a catalyst, yeah.
A pressure group. Uh-huh. They've actually been inspired by UKIP.
I'm sure Nigel will be very pleased.
Exactly. In the sense of, you can then change the way that information policy has been changed.
Okay. Yeah.
So I just wondered, either what would your subject of the novel think of that, do you think, or what do you think of that? Do you think that's an interesting thing with your political background?
Well, I think the subject of the novel, it's not a novel, it's real. It happened. All of this. Yes, I know. It's a history of a woman. I think she was in it, wasn't she? The suffragettes, WSPU, were that, weren't they? They were saying, give us a space, and if you're not going to give it, we're going to take it. You know, so they were sort of a combustible catalyst. They were that. I need to know more about it. I wish I'd gone to that meeting. I really am. Honestly, I'm not evading the question. I'm very, very late to that particular... I saw Sandy Toksvig's name appear, and anything that Sandy's in, I think it's probably going to be really good and funny.
Okay, I'll take you to the next one.
I'll come with you. I really would like to, because I am. I'm just... It's challenging my notion of I always think, you know, those people... You know, the Russell Brandism of, like, stand at the outside and shake your fist... is such a waste of energy.
Yeah.
You know, it's such a waste of energy. People, you will just be on the outside. That's what you'll be. You will change it from the inside. So I really want to see how that works. I would love to.
Oh, yeah. I'm really frustrated because we all want to... I want to ask more questions, and I think the room does too, but I am being commanded. Anita, it's really been fascinating. I think we could all sit here for another hour and just talk about this and listen to you. And I think it's a really, really engaging book, and it's a moving book. So read it.
I mean, I don't know if there's another room. I will stay for a little while. I know some of you might have books that you want signed, but I'm very happy to chat.
Continue the conversation.
Anita
and Anne, thank you so much.